Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Brian, and I'm an alcoholic. And I come from New York. I come from the Upper East Side, in an area called Yorkville. Mostly immigrants, I'm first generation, hard-working people, hard drinkers. And I don't remember the first time I picked a drink, but I do remember the first time I pulled a blank, the first time I had a blackout. I was 13 years old. Somehow, looking back over my life, I seem to be able to remember more things about growing up as a boy than most things as a man. And I remember I was about 13 years old, Johnny and I, a friend of mine, we had some money in our pockets from hustling newspapers in the saloons the night before. And I went down 97th Street between Lexington and Park Avenue to this vacant building. And we went in the back and there was a whole camp of winos laying there. They were all passed out. And I remember going in, kicking this one guy and giving him the high sign. And he got up and he shuffled out. And we gave him enough money to go get us 3 pints of Sneaky Pete. A pint for him, a pint for myself, a pint for Johnny. And I remember this man as the most handsomest man I could ever remember. He stood about 6'2", he had jet black curly hair, big blue eyes. The most he could have been was anywhere from about 28 to 33 years old, 35. And here he was, an old, young, dirty man. He was a wino. I remember 3 years prior to that, at the end of the Second World War, at one of the biggest block parties New York had thrown for the returning sailors and soldiers and Marines, and the wax, the waves, the bands, the merchant seamen. And I remember all the hoi polloi in New York, Mayor LaGuardia and Vito Marcantonio and all the big mucky mucks and the godfathers, and they were all around trying to get their photograph taken with this guy because he was a war hero. Tokyo Rose had mentioned his name on the program a couple of times in the Pacific, that they had a special scouting group of Japanese out there trying to kill him. And here he was, an old, young, dirty man doing the biddings of 2 13-year-olds. I come from a work ethnic background, and the only requirement for becoming a man was a desire to work. As long as you had a desire to work, you could beat your wife, beat the kids, beat the system, you could beat anything you want. As long as you had a desire to work. And these winos broke the cardinal rule. They didn't work. And they were ostracized in these vacant buildings and their vacant lots and the benches along the East River. And he went and got the pint and he took his pint and he shuffled back into the building, and Johnny and I went way in the back of the vacant lots where there was a little lean-to. And I cracked my pint and Johnny cracked his, and I started drinking and Johnny started drinking, and we're laughing and giggling and body punching and arm wrestling. We knocked off the 2 pints. I remember walking up the block to go dig out this wino to go get us 3 more pints. And I remember walking up and I'm bumping into the people and I'm pushing them aside. It was my first experience with deer muscles. I was about that high, thinking, I'm pushing them. And he went and he dug out, we dug him out, and he went and he got his 3 more pints, and he took his pint. And I remember it was about 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon when I cracked that second pint. I remember it was about 2 o'clock when I put it to my mouth. And the next thing I knew, I come out of a blackout. My mother had my head over the kitchen tubs. I was throwing up all this wine into the tubs. My 2 brothers were leaning over, and they were pounding the hell out of me, screaming at me where the hell I had been all day. Because the neighbors had come and told my mother that his son was drunk, and he was staggering all over the street. And my mother was out, and the neighbors was out, and they scoured the whole neighborhood, and they didn't find me until about 11 o'clock at night. And I just couldn't tell them where I had been. Till 11 o'clock at night. I remember it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I cracked the pint, and here it was 11 o'clock at night, and I just didn't know. Now, up until the age of 13, at these block parties and beer barrel parties and welcome home parties, I've been drunk many a time. But this was the first time I pulled a blank. This was the first time that I had a blackout at 13. And it bothered me. It really bothered me. A couple of days later, I'm walking up the neighborhood, and one of these big guys come walking down. I knew him from hustling papers, was shining his shoes. And I stopped him, and I started to explain what had happened. I remember he was a big guy. He was rocking back and forth. He had his hands in his hips, and his hair was hanging in his eyes. And he got a big smile on his face, and he's rocking back and forth. And I'm looking up at him, and I'm telling him what had happened. And when I finished, he turned around, and he said, "Kid, were you drinking, kid?" And I said, yeah, I was drinking. He said, "Were you drunk?" I said, yeah, I was drunk. And he leaned back and he shrugged. He didn't say anything. He just shrugged, gave me a big smile, tossed in my head, walked around me and kept walking. It seems like I'd been born and raised with what I would call this alcoholic shrug. I've seen it all my life. I remembered walking to a bar. There wouldn't be a soul in the bar. And I said, where the hell is everybody? They say, I don't know. Look, looking for Joe's car. He doesn't know where he parked it last night. They'd be going up and down, walking around looking for it. And somebody would say, was Joe drinking last night? They say, yeah. Was Joe drunk last night? They say, yeah. They just shrugged. Never said nothing. They just shrugged and went about their business. I'd walk in the bar and say, Mary's on the phone. She's hysterical. She's crazy. She doesn't know where she left the children. She's going crazy. And somebody would say, is Mary drinking? They say, yeah. Is Mary drunk? They say, yeah. And they just shrugged. They didn't say anything about it. Well, when I was 14, you had to be 16 years old to get in the pool rooms. And that's where all the action was. So I broke into the church rectory. I robbed a pair of baptismal papers along with the church seal. And I forged my papers, made myself 16. I sold off the rest. And at 16, you had to be 18 to get your seaman's papers without your parents' consent. So I used the phony papers, and I got my seaman's papers. And I just turned 17. I ran away, and I went to sea. And the shrug followed me. I mean, no way. No matter where I went, this shrug, it was like some kind of a voodoo or juju. It was like international. No matter where I remember my first trip, I was in Singapore, and I was in a nightclub. And I got into a big fight, and I got pretty bad cut up and beat up. And the gendarmes came, and they took me to the hospital where they stitched me up. And then they took me, and they threw me in a tank, and they had me there for 3 days. Now, in those days, Singapore was still a British Crown colony. And I remember when they pulled me out of the tank, and they took me to court, and they threw me up there in the docket. I looked like one of these punk rockers or one of these wrestlers. Half of the head was shaved like a mohawk and all stitched up, and the rest of the hair was all pointed and all different color from the process. My face was a mess, and the stitches were stuck to the blood. I was standing there a mess. And in these days, I mean, I remember looking up at the magistrate. He had a big white curly wig on and a black flowing robe, and representing me was the American consulate. And I'm standing there, this mess in the docket. And I remember the judge leaning down saying to the American consulate, he said, was the bloke drinking? And the American consulate leaned over to me and said, were you drinking? And I leaned over and I looked at the American consulate, eyeball to eyeball, one American to another. And I said, was I drinking? I said, of course I was drinking. You don't think I look like this sober, do you? I said, what the hell kind of an American do you think I am anyway? I said, of course I was drinking. We're all drunk. He looked up and he said, yes, your magistrate, the bloke was drinking. And the judge leaned back and he went like this here. The American consul went like that. The captain went like that. I went like that. And ladies and gentlemen, that's the story of my life in a nutshell. It was just one shrug after another. That's where alcohol took me. It reduced me and my life to a human shrug. They said the ship sailed for Panama last night. Was Brian aboard? Yeah. Did Brian come out? Did Brian go home last night? Is Brian going to have to do any time? Does Brian have any money left? Whatever happened to that nice girl Brian was going with? Where the hell is Brian? And that's the story, ladies and gentlemen, in a nutshell. About 1969, I was on a drunk, and I come out of a blackout in the apartment, and I'm weaving in and out of this blackout, and I got a phone on my hand. And I'm listening to this voice on the phone. And the voice is saying, take it easy, Brian, take it easy. Give us your address, we'll send a couple of men over to talk to you. And I couldn't quite figure out who this voice was, so I want to send a couple of men over to talk to me. So I threw out a couple of words, hoping maybe he'd bite, and I could fill in around the sentence and figure out who the guy was. And the guy kept saying, take it easy, Brian, take it easy. Give us your address, we'll send a couple of men up. I said, wait a minute, what do you mean give me my address? I said, who the hell are you anyway? He says, I'm so-and-so from Intergroup. I said, so-and-so? I mean, now, if you never heard the word Intergroup before, you have to admit it sounds like some kind of a communist word. I said, Intergroup? I said, what the hell are you talking about? Who the hell is Intergroup? He said, Brian, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, how the hell did you get my number? He said, you just called us up. I said, I call you up. What the hell would I call you up for? He said, take it easy, Brian. Take it easy. Give me your address. I said, wait a minute. Hold it there. Don't you be sending anybody around here starting trouble. You want something? I'll give you a punch in the puss. That's what I'll give you. And I hung up the phone. I sat down. I put my head in my hands, and the sweat started pouring over me, and my mind kept racing back and forth in retrospect, trying to figure out what in God's name did I do this time that Intergroup would be after me. mean, the only thing I knew about Interpol was the old Second World War movies, you know, with Jimmy Cady and Humphrey Bogart, and in those movies, when an Interpol was after you, and that one thing, you know? So I got up and I put the light out, and I leaned up and I looked out the peephole of the door, thinking maybe I see somebody around there, you know, and then I crept across the floor and I leaned up against the window, I pulled the shades back and I searched out the doorways across the street, thinking maybe I see an intergroup guy over there, you know, looking up. The hell did I know? By 1970, I was on the drunk again. I come out of a blackout and I'm leaving in and out and I'm talking to his voice again. And the voice told me where the meeting was, and I went to the meeting. And the meeting in those days was the old Butterfield Group in 72nd Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenue. And I went, and the only thing I heard at that meeting was stay out of one bar at a time. Now, in my rummy head looking back, I'm sure he was saying stay away from one drink at a time. But I heard stay out of one bar at a time. I walked out of the meeting, I walked up to 72nd Street and 3rd Avenue, and I went from 72nd Street and 3rd Avenue all the way to 93rd Street and 3rd Avenue. And believe me, there were saloons to the right and beer gardens. I was surrounded, but I kept walking. I walked into one of these bars that I drank in. I walked up, I ordered up my usual serving up drink, which was a large club soda with a big squeeze of lemon. I'm standing at the bar, and all of a sudden, I felt my body starting to shake, and my brain and my legs, and I went into a fit. When I came out of the fit, I was in an ambulance with a friend of mine, Jackie, and this big attendant, he was kneeling on top of me, trying to ram something in my mouth, and I heard the sirens and the screaming, and I couldn't figure out what in God's name was going on. I grabbed the guy, I rolled him over, I got on top of him, I started beating the shit out of him. He started screaming to the driver to stop the ambulance. The ambulance came to a screech and halted. The driver come around, he opened the door, he looked in, I gave him a kick and a puss. I jumped down, I took off like a shot. Jackie went over, he gave him a kick and a puss. He jumped down, he started running after me. I'm running up this block, Jackie's chasing me. I ran down this block, Jackie's chasing me. I spotted the bar, I go running in the bar, I'm huffing and puffing the bar. Jackie comes running in, he's huffing and puffing. The people are looking, I grab him, we go over the side. I said, what the hell happened? God damn it, Jackie, what was all that about? What happened? He says, I don't know. He says, you come in the bar, everything was all right. Next thing you went into some kind of fit. Now, the only thing I could attribute this fit to was this intergroup anonymous. I mean, you know, I mean, they told me to stay out of one bar at a time. I walked all along Third Avenue, passing these bars, nothing happened to me. I went in one stinking bar, and I woke up in an ambulance. And I said, Jesus Christ, no wonder these people are anonymous. I mean, they could kill you in broad daylight and never leave a fingerprint. I said, the hell with that intergroup anonymous stuff, Jack. I said, they had one crack at me, and they goddamn near killed me. I said, the hell with that, man. By 1969, I'm on a ship, we're about 5 days out of the Suez, and I'm on a drunk, I had booze hidden all over the ship, and the word came down to batten down the hatches and go down the portholes, that a storm was about to hit, and I'm in the forecastle, and I'm drinking, and somehow I thought this storm was after me. And when the storm came, I got the bottle, I threw the door out, and I sprang it out into the deck, and I'm laughing at it, and peeing against it, and throwing punches, and I'm laughing and singing, and it's slamming me all over the place. The end of the world, the result was it busted my shoulder, and they wanted to take me off in Egypt, and I won't get off. I figured in a few days we'll go through the Suez, we'll get up to Naples, and I get up in Naples. And I did. And they had me in the hospital after 3 days, and they put me in a body cast with a big ball underneath the arm. And the agent came and picked me up and drove me all the way out to Rome, to the airport. We were sitting there at the airport, we had a 2-hour layover. And I said to him, I said, you married? He said, yeah, I'm married. I said, you got kids? He said, yeah. I said, look, the plane's right here. It's a 2-hour layover. I said, what the hell are you wasting your time here with me? I got the big bar there. What are you wasting your time with me? I said, well, I'll spend some time with your kids. You know? I said, I'll just get some postcards and write the boys and mail them out to the guys in the bar and let them know what's going on. He took off, and I sat at the bar and sat right now. And I had a little cappuccino, and next thing I said, throw a little brandy in there. And he threw a little brandy. Next thing I'm drinking, I'm drunk on the plane. When that gangbang went down in New York, I come off like a drunken runaway construction boom. I'm going over, and I'm banging people in the chin, and they're all ducking. And I fell on the escalator and jammed it with the bar and the sparks and the thing. Well, in anyway, 1970, we're 3 days out of Seattle bound for Japan, and I'm on a drunk. I got booze stashed all over the ship, and the word comes down to batten down the hatches and throw down the porthole that a storm is about to hit. And somehow I said, Jesus, that storm is still after me. Then, you know, there's another ship, he's after me. Then I'm drinking by the time the storm hits, so I go out in the deck, and I'm laughing and throwing punches and spitting and laughing and gigging and peeing, and then and was slamming me all up. Big wave took me, picked me up, and threw me up, slammed me up against a hatch, and busted the shot at the whole lower part of my back. So it had me tied down, so we got to Japan where they took me off, and they had me in the hospital for 16 days where they operated on me. And I hadn't drank now in about a month, I guess. And the agent picks me up and drives me all the way out to Tokyo. There was about a two-hour layover. I said to him, you married? He says, yeah. I said, you got kids? He says, yeah. I said, look, geez, the plane is right here. Don't worry. Get home. We'll spend some time with your wife. I'll just get some cards, write the boys in the bar, let them know what's going on. I sat at the bar, and I'm writing out the postcards, and I see the kettle there, and I tell the guy, heat up a little sake. Yeah, totally, heat up a little sake. Next thing I'm drinking, I'm drunk in a plane. I passed out when it came through. There was a big puddle of blood all over that was bleeding where the drain had come out. They had me in the back with my pants down and wiped me clean. They had to bottle one of those old-fashioned Kotexes and pack me with the Kotex. And by the time the plane got to Anchorage, Alaska, they had to get my luggage out and change my clothes. And finally, I got to New York. I'm in the apartment. I figured, the hell with this going to sea? I mean, it seems like every time I go out there, there's this whole school of angry elements and Moby Dicks. Just waiting. I mean, I had nothing against Captain Ahab. It's me that they're waiting for. And I mean, I like going to sea, but I don't want to die over the goddamn thing. You know? So what the hell with it? So I went back to work in the tunnels. I've been a sand hog most of my life, and for those of you who don't know, and where the New York miners, we're the ones who work in the tunnels, in the compressed air to work the, and you know, the compression chambers, and so I went back to work in the tunnels, and about 1971, I was on the drunk, and I hear this banging at the door, this banging and banging and banging at the door, and I go, open up the door, I'll kick it in, open it up, and it was the delegate, the union delegate. And so I opened the door, and I said, Jesus Christ, keep your mouth down. Keep your voice down. Don't let the whole neighborhood know what the hell is going on. He said, what the hell are you doing? Jesus, this place stinks. And he went over, and he opened up the drapes and threw up the window, and man, there was bottles all over the place. I was on this here drunk. He said, what the hell are you doing, Brian? God damn it. What are you doing? He said, what's the big deal? I'm just having a few drinks. He said, a few drinks? He said, how long do you think you've been on this drunk? I said, I don't know, a few days or something. He said, you've been on this bridge now for 6 weeks. He said, I can't keep covering you on the job. I was the dynamiter on the job. He says, I can't keep covering you. He said, when the hell are you coming back to work? And I said, well, what's today? He said, today's Wednesday. I said, all right. I said, I'll be back Monday. He said, Brian, please. I said, look, you can take book on it. I'll be back Monday. I mean, and he says, all right. And all I ever needed all my life, anywhere around the world to come off a drunk was, usually I could bail out in about 3 days. All I needed was a floor, some water, and a toilet. And you go through the whips and the jingles and the runs, and you went through whatever you had. Usually I could bail out in 3 days, and I did. And I went back to work Monday at 7 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock, they called for the dynamite. I load up the dynamite, get in the cage, I'm dropping 850 feet. Down to the tunnel level, we go into the compression chamber. And once you get in the chamber and you go through and you start heading for the tunnel, all the lights are knocked out. And they roll back all the lights for fear that maybe an electric charge will set off and, you know, kill everybody in the tunnel. So all the dynamite is loaded with headlights and lamp lights and air lights, and it's eerie. And they got up there and they started loading the dynamite, and I went into a fit. And they're all yelling, what the hell's going on? They said, I don't know. It's Brian. Where is he? He's over there. No, he's over there. Watch out. You're standing on him. I'm flopping. I'm pulling the dynamite. I'm flopping all over. So they called out. They called out for an ambulance, and the ambulance heard about the dynamite, and they called the police. And the police heard about the, at that time, there was a lot of dynamite and a lot of killing going on in New York. And the word went out. There was a mad bomb, and men were trapped in the bowels of the earth. And by the time they got me out, the mayor was there and the bomb squad was there, and I had the flak jackets and binoculars and baseball bats, and I come out and I get up and I peed my pants, I'm shaking like a leaf, and the mayor's blowing his top, they're wasting his time with this drunken fool, and they were all pissed off at me, and they were claiming I was an epileptic. And if you're an epileptic, they won't allow you to work in the tunnels around dynamite or run the motor or anything for fear that maybe you're going through a fit and you wind up killing here in the tunnel. So they wouldn't allow me to go back in the dynamite until I went to Lenoxville Hospital for a whole battery of epilepsy tests, which I did. I went through all the tests, and a couple of days later, I was sitting outside the neurosurgeon's office waiting to be called in. He stepped out of his office and said, Mr. Mines, I raised my hand. He gave me the high sign. And I took this big, deep breath as I walked into his office. And he's sitting there at his desk, you know, looking at these charts and graphs. And he said, well, Mr. Mines, everything here looks pretty negative. And I heard the word negative, and I let my breath out just a little bit. And I said, what do you mean negative, doctor? He said, well, everything here looks pretty good. Everything here is all right. And I let my breath out just a little bit more. I said, you mean to say, doctor, I'm not an epileptic? He said, no, you're not an epileptic. You're an alcoholic. I said, yeah. I said, I'm not an epileptic, though, right? He said, no, you're an alcoholic. I said, then I didn't have an epileptic fit in the tunnel. He said, no, you had an alcoholic seizure. I said, oh, thank God. I grabbed him. I started to hug him. I mean, I couldn't care less about being an alcoholic. What the hell would I care about being an alcoholic? You know what I mean? Give me a good old-fashioned alcoholic any day. It's those goddamn epileptics. They're the ones that get you fired, you know? So I had him write it, put it in writing, and went back to the job. I saw the safety engineer in the job. I threw it on his desk, and I leaned over. I said, here, look at that. I'm an athlete, not a nifty. Here it is, right here. So he said, so you're an alcoholic. I said, you're goddamn right. It's right there, you know? He said, so am I. I said, no kidding. He said, yeah. He said, you're going back to work? I said, yeah. He said, you want a drink? I said, sure. We closed the door. He pulled out a bottle. He started sucking on a bottle. They called for the dynamite. They get on the cage. He's starting dropping down. And God, life was good. I mean, life was good. Here I had my job back. I mean, they couldn't fire me. I'm only an algae, you know? And I just found a newfound friend with a bottle tucked away. I mean, you know, I mean, life was good. But there was a friend of mine, Joe, who had been sober in AA for 7 years, and he had heard about the trouble I was in. And he came up to the house, and he said, look, Brian, why the hell don't you come to a couple of AA meetings with me? And this time I agreed to go. And the only reason I agreed to go was that I just couldn't seem to get a handle on these convulsions. I mean, I was convulsing on subway platforms in the middle of the street. You just didn't know when they were going to hit, and I agreed to go. And we went and we made back-to-back meetings. And at the second meeting, I heard the speaker guarantee that if you don't pick up the first drink, you can't get drunk. He guaranteed that it's impossible to get drunk if you don't pick up that first drink. And as the meeting ended, I made a beeline for the stairs. Everybody stopped. And they started to say to Our Father. And I was shocked. And I searched out the group and I found Joe. And there was Joe. He was standing there and he had his eyes closed and his head down. He was holding his two fingers. And he was rocking back and forth saying to Our Father. And I looked at him and I said, Joe, what the hell did they do to you, Joe? I mean, here was a guy we were born and raised together, went to sea together, now we're working the tunnels together, and here he is rocking to Jesus and Psalm singing with the best of them, yo. Well, after we went a couple of blocks away for coffee, and I'm sitting in a restaurant, and all the people from AA come in, and they start to fill in the booths. And I leaned over to him, I said, Joe, how long are you in AA, Joe? Joe said, 7 years. I said, Joe, this has nothing to do with those people over there. It's just between you and me. We go back a long way. I said, Joe, did you understand that man back there that said, if you don't pick up the first drink, you can't get drunk? Did you understand him, Joe? And Joe said, yeah, sure, I understand him. I said, Joe, deep down in the caverns of your bowels, Joe, do you really understand what that man said, that it's impossible to get drunk if you don't pick up the first drink? Did you understand him? Joe said, sure, I understand. What the hell are you trying to say? I said, Joe, I'm trying to say that you're being bullshitting, man. Of course you can't get drunk if you don't pick up the first drink. Joe, that's like me telling you, guaranteeing you, if you don't leave the house tomorrow, you won't get run over by a truck. Joe, it's all happy horseshit. You're throwing good money in the basket full of bullshit. And he said, look, please, Brian, please, here, take the meeting book, try 90 days. I said, Joe, please, Joe, maybe you don't mind sitting there in the front row, Joe, humped over, squinting up at the speaker, slurping your lips to sobriety like some kind of an AA Quasimodo. I said, Joe, that isn't my idea of being a man. What the hell happened to you, Joe? Where's your pride? Where's your dignity? And he said, look, why don't you take this meeting? I said, Joe, please. Mark my words, Joe. I'm a friend of yours. Mark my words. You keep hanging around with those people, and you're going to be here for another 7 years. Mark my words, Joe. Just then, the bell from the church that we just started ringing, I broke out laughing. And I said, Joe, you better get back there. Somebody got your job. And I took off. Now, that was in the early fall of 71. And I went to all the holidays. I didn't have a drink. I had big money now. I was back working. I went to all the holidays, you know. Never picked up a drink. I'm born and raised up in New York. I live in 86th Street. 86th Street is where the St. Patrick's Day Parade breaks up. I mean, I know thousands of people, hundreds. That's where we congregate every St. Patrick's Day. They come far and wide, and it's like a whole neighborhood reunion. And I remember my nieces came in from Westchester, and we were walking up toward Lexington Avenue, and I had a camel head coat on, big green shamrock tie, a Russian Cossack hat surrounded by shamrocks, and everybody screaming at me, yelling at me, slapping me on the back. And I got up Lexington and Park Avenue, we started passing the bottle around. The bottle came to me, I pulled the plug. And this time I was in the grip of the grape for 2 weeks. I was on the drunk for 2 weeks this time. The fears were so great that I never left the apartment for 2 weeks. I had the doors locked, the windows locked, the shades drawn. I had the phone off the hook. The only phone call I made was for the liquor store to have the booze to live it. And for 2 weeks I was totally isolated. And only an alcoholic would understand that I loved it. God, I loved it. The only friends and enemies I had was the furniture. I would stand in the middle of the room with my legs spread, my shoulders squared away, my eyes squinting toward the horizon, the wind gently tossing my hair, my nose swelled with excitement, my teeth bared with lust, my chest slowly heaving, my hands hanging open and closing when anxious. I would stand there truly, truly a man amongst men. All things to women. Jackie Nassas would be kneeling on the ground with her arms around my knees saying, I love you, Brian, I love you. Please, take the money, take the money. And I'd throw my head back and laugh and say, money? You can't buy a man like me with money. And I'd pick her up and I'd crawl out the door. Next minute, they'd be banging at the door. I'd open the door, be Sophie alone. Please, Brian, I heard just once, and I'd crawl out and I'd slam the door and I'd yell through the door, why don't you goddamn women leave me alone? Can't you see I'm only human? Leave me alone, goddammit. I'd be standing in the middle of the room huffing and puffing, huffing and puffing, because I had just knocked out Muhammad Ali for the heavyweight championship of the world. And I would always knock him on March 16th so they would beg me to lead the St. Patrick's Day Parade. And lead it I wouldn't. And I could see myself making that wide turn on 5th Avenue and 86th Street, the home stretch. And the major domo standing there with the big stick in the air. And all when Brian was in place, he'd bring the stick down. And all the bagpipes and the drums and the fiddles and the screaming and the yelling. And the cops would be on the horses skittering all over the place. And the other cops would be on the ground with their arms locked trying to hold back the surging crowd of women. And they'd be yelling, there's Brian! There's the champ! My God, that's him! And every now and then I'd hear the cops say, what a man! What a man! I'd be standing in the middle of the room and I'd have a bottle in my hand. I'd be weaving back, holding the bottle up, weaving back and forth. The hairs would be wild and matted with sweat from the drunk and the dribbly old t-shirt. Everything I drank and puked would be all over the t-shirt and barely hanging out my hips. It would be these warm, wrinkled, spotty shorts. And I'd be weaving back, holding the tears. The tears would be running down my eyes because it was the third year in a row I had won the Academy Award. Well, anyway, April 1st, April Fool's Day, 1972, Intergroup finally came and got me. They took me off to a 5-day detox. And I don't ever want to forget, they were taking me down to drunk session, and my brother-in-law had one arm, and the nurse had the other arm, and the hair was wild and matted from that 2-week drunk, and I had a 2-week growth, the vomity, dribbly old t-shirt, and these pea-stained pair of pants with the fly broken half open, so I never needed a belt. Just pull them off, throw them in the corner, pull them up, pull them back up, go out. And naturally, those warm, wrinkled, faithful, spotty pair of shorts. I mean, they went with me. If I staggered in the street and fell, they staggered and fell. If I got locked up for the weekend, they got locked up for the weekend. And mark my words, ladies and gentlemen, one day those shorts will be holding their own meetings, believe me. And God knows they deserve them. And as they were getting me down closer to the men's lounge, right opposite was the nurses. And as they were taking the three of us down there, this guy through the corner of my eye, he stepped out and he saw the three of us coming down. And he walked back into the men's lounge. He said, "Hey guys, come out and look at this guy, a real wolf man. Take a look at this guy here." And they come out and they looked and they all start laughing and they're ooh, and they're yelling, "Don't touch him, nurse, don't touch him, you get locked, you are." And they're all, "Your fingers are not off, one at a time," and they're all laughing. And I remember one guy saying, nah, that guy's not real. He's an April Fool's Day. He's just trying to scare us. That guy's not real. And this is the first time in my life, ladies and gentlemen, that a man or a woman ever laughed at me, and I couldn't do anything about it. I remember I was standing there, and I had my head down. And you know how those voices, that voice, that soul-sickening voice that tortured me all my life, started digging into me, saying, look at them laughing at you. You've been nothing but a laughing stock all your life. For once in your life, try to do something right. For once, try to be a man. God damn it, get your head up. Get your head up. Look at these bastards in the face. Don't let them laugh at you. And I kept trying to get my head up. But it seems like somebody used a machete and cut up all my neck muscles and my back muscles. I just couldn't get my head up. And if there was one thing at that moment I wish I could have done, and that was to grab myself by the head of the hair, yank my face up, and spit right into it. That's how I felt about myself. It was the second day over my 38th birthday, and I was physically bankrupt, mentally bankrupt, spiritually bankrupt, financially bankrupt, and sexually bankrupt. I see now it's a body that I've been slipping in and out of intimacy since I was about 28 years old. And it was tough. I was a sand hog and a seaman and a bartender, and I'd be in the bar and all the guys would be talking about, this guy took the girl home last night and he made love to her three times. And this guy over here, he took the girl home and he made love to her three times. And this guy over here, he took the girl home and he made love to her three times. Well, I see now it's a body that if these guys were taking these girls home, making love to her three times a night, one thing was for sure, they didn't drink what I was drinking, that's for sure. You don't drink that stuff and go home, make love two or three times. You go home and fall out of the bed two or three times. The closest they're going to get to sex is when they get up and pee-pee two or three times. Now, I don't want to belabor the sex thing. I don't want to get into the sex thing. But the only reason I throw it out there is because maybe there's some guy out there that kind of knows what I'm talking about. As for the women, they know what I'm talking about. And I remember I was laying in bed, I couldn't get out, I was all dehydrated, I was in bad shape, I was laying in bed, I was there about the second day, and I guess it was about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and this nurse came in, and with the flare lights behind her, it was like an apparition or something, it was like a vision of loveliness. She came in, she had long, sheen, black hair, and big white eyes that reflected the flare lights, and she looked rich. She looked like she was born with a silver spoon in her mouth. That she never had worked a day in her life. And she came over, and I'm laying there, and I still got the beard and the party shorts, and I'm still laying there. And she sat on the bed, and she started to talk to me in a cooing-like way. And I knew that she meant well, that all this was part of a job. But I just couldn't take this bald-faced hypocrisy, you know. And I said, look, I know you mean well, but why don't you just get the hell out of here? Get out of here. Don't bullshit me. I've been in worse situations like this. I'll beat this. Just get out of here. You don't even know what the hell you're talking about. And she got up and she said, all right, Brian. She said, I'll leave you. But then she leaned over. She looked me right in the face. She said, but don't you ever tell me I don't know what you're going through. She said, Brian, I'm an alcoholic, and I've been in many a room like this and many a bed like that. Ladies and gentlemen, when she said that she was an alcoholic, it was like the fist of God come out of nowhere and slammed me and hit me with such an impact that if it wasn't for the springs, it would have driven me right through to death. Never, never in my life did I ever think that there was such a thing as a woman alcoholic. I didn't even know the word alcoholic. There were drunks and rhinos and creeps and freeloaders and go forth. But here, I drank with women all over the world, all over. And I drank with them, believe me. And we never called them an alcoholic because usually these were our friends' mothers or wives or sisters or daughters or sweethearts. And I drank with them all over. I remember walking along the avenue once, and this lady, she was way in the back with the bottle gang over these bricks and everything. She called me and she was laughing, and I saw her, and I went back and she bumped some cigarettes at me. And I gave her a few bucks, and she had an old house dress on with most of the buttons missing, the Brazilian panties long gone. And she was laughing and joking, and I looked down at her feet, and they were caked with black, dry, dirty blood from walking the streets searching for a drink. And never in a million years did I think that this woman was an alcoholic. This was my friend's mother, just on a bad run. But somehow when this nurse said to me that she was an alcoholic, this miracle of mercy, this message of AA, this miracle of mercy broke through. And I understood it all. To this day, I'm still trying to figure out what I understood, but I knew at that moment that this woman was an alcoholic. And I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic. And the thing that I saw at that moment was I realized that if this woman picked up a drink, in 2 weeks' time, she'd be laying a human stink in a bed like me. Because I realized I looked just like her when I was walking up to the parade. I remember my nieces and I had this, and I looked just like her. And here I was, and somehow I connected it with the first drink. And I got out in 5 days, and they suggested 90 days, 90 meetings. Get a meeting book, sit up front, and I did. And after the meeting, I would get one of the old-timers aside, and I call the old-timer aside, and I say, look, where did you get this 90 days, 90 meetings concept? Where did you get, and none of them seem to know, and I grab another old-timer, where did you get 90 days, 90 meetings? Where did you get it? And none of them seem to know, and they couldn't care less. They said, look, there's no hard and fast rule. I mean, we don't pick up a drink a day at a time. I mean, you know, but it was important to me. It was important to me to find out where they got 90 days, 90 meetings from, because I didn't want to make the same mistake twice. I remember when I was a kid in school, I was always being beaten and punished over these mystical, esoteric numbers. I remember there was the 12 apostles and the 10 commandments and the 12 lost tribes of Israel and the 7 deadly sins and the 8 wonders of the ancient world and the 4 winds and the 9 planets and the 7 seas. And Moses was in the desert for 40 years. And Columbus was on the Atlantic 40 days, 40 nights. And now me, 90 days, 90 meetings. I mean, what did it mean? Did it mean I'm cosmic? What did it mean? And nobody seemed to know. But it didn't take me long. It didn't take me long to figure it out. And I came to the conclusion that you have to be here 90 days, 90 meetings just to understand what the hell they're talking about. Because there's an anonymous way of speaking at these meetings. The topic would be, you see, when you made a decision not to make a decision, you made a decision. They go, oh my God, what a topic, what a topic. They would say, you see, it was in not taking the action, but you took the action. They go, oh my God, my circuit speaker, they go crazy. The one that got me was, you see, you can't keep it unless you give it away. In fact, you have to give it away to keep it. And the more you give, the more you get. And I lean over and I say to my sponsor, Joe, I say, Joe, what the hell are they giving away? They don't work. The world I'm employed on welfare. Joe, half of them are an alimony. Can't you see, Joe? And Joe says, see what? I said, can't you see, man? We're being bullshitted. We're throwing good money in the basket for a happy horses. He said, are you still on that kick, for God's sake? And he get his cup, and I see him go all the way up to another part of the room, and I say to myself, go ahead and run. Run, you stinking AAS kisser. This seems like that's all they do around here. Stay away from the drink, come to meetings, and kiss her ass. But I'll tell you something, Jerry boy, it'll be a cold day in hell before they get a man like me to bend over and kiss her ass. I'll tell you that. And I sit there in the front row, and I look around and look at the women. Oh, my heart was broken. I look at these beautiful types of women, and my heart would just go out to them. It was broken. I mean, it seems like their whole life was over. It seems like their whole life now revolved around needle pointing. I mean, every now and then from the back of the room, I hear a big burst of ooing and aahing, and I knew that they just discovered a new swallow pattern. And I can see in my mind's eye them sitting there, pearl one, drop two, identify. Pearl one, drop two, identify. And they just keep pearling and dropping, identifying, I guess, right till the menopause, and then right on till death. And I say to Joe, it's really unfair, Joe. I mean, look at them. You can just look at them, Joe, and see, they never did anything, Joe. And they never will now. Their sponsors will say they're out. And I remember it seems like the first 90 days I kept running into the same cluster of speakers. And it seems like each and every one of them had a little gimmick, you know, a little slogan they were selling. There was Easy, Desert Diane, One Day at a Time, Perry, Babyface, Georgia, You know, easy does. And I had nicknames for all these speakers. I gave them all these nicknames. And I remember this one speaker got up there and I introduced him, and his name was Charlie. And Charlie went into a store and he said, I picked up a drink, I fell on a flight of stairs, and I surrendered. And they all started to applaud and hug him and kiss him, get his autograph, invite him to parties. I sat there stunned. I mean, he picked up a drink, fell on a flight of stairs and surrendered. Man, I fell off gangways, garbage cans, and never, never in a million years would I ever tell a shit story like that in public. I mean, this guy told a story right in front of the girls. I said, he'll never get a girl from a story like that. I mean, geez, you know. And I immediately nicknamed him Staircase Charlie. And about a week later, they introduced Staircase Charlie again. And I got right up front. And I hung on every word he said. Because it was very important to me to find out what kind of a staircase it was that made him surrender. Now, maybe he's going to say he picked up a drink and he fell down a four-story spiral staircase. Well, all right, you come. Yeah, I'll go along with that. Well, maybe he's going to say he picked up a drink and he fell five stories between the banisters. Well, yeah, you got to go with that one. But it's somehow the way he looked and the way he talked and the way he dressed that I knew that this guy was strictly a two-step foyer job, you know? And he went into a store and he said, I picked up a drink, I fell down a flight of stairs, and I surrendered. They started to applaud and hug him and kiss him, get his autograph, invite him to parties. I sat there and said to myself, why don't the guy tell the real story? The guy was drinking all day. He was drunk. He was drunk. That's why he fell down a flight of stairs. You see, they kept telling me, Brian, keep bringing the body, bring the body. Sooner or later, the head follows. Here it was a week later, I heard the same story, but I heard it just a little bit different. And they introduced him about a week and a half later. Now, this is the third time within a month of hearing this guy. I knew his story by heart. And I'm sitting there, and he went into his story, and as he got close to picking up that first drink, I felt my stomach tighten up. I said, uh-oh, watch that drink, Charlie. Watch that drink. And he got closer to the drink. I said, Charlie, can't you see what you're doing? Watch the drink, Charlie. And Charlie said, and I picked up a drink, and I said, oh, well, grease the banisters, there goes Charlie. I know my heart of hearts, ladies and gentlemen, once he picked up the drink, no way in hell could he beat the staircase. I'd lay out from here to Vegas. I knew he was going down that flight of stairs. It shows I'm standing here. It was the first time in my life I fully identified with the first drink. And I kept coming to the meetings and things, and I kept coming to the meetings. And I remember having lunch with my mother. And I'm having lunch, I'm sitting at the table, and I'm looking over, and on the dresser, she had one of those novelty birds. You remember the old birds? You used to bend them over and put them in the water, and they go up and down, they keep nodding and drinking the water. And I'm looking at it, it's going up and down, and I felt like getting up and just slapping it off the dresser. You know what I mean? I said, Mom, what kind of bird is that? And she said, what are you talking about? I said, the bird. The bird is going up and down. She says, I know, it's a novelty bird. I said, I know, Mom, but it's really important to me. What's the name of it? And she said, well, it's a dodo bird. And that was it. And I vowed then and there never to become an AA dodo bird. They used to enrage me, these AA dodo birds. I'd be sitting at the meeting, and a speaker would say, I finally took my sponsor's advice, and I went to the bank manager, and I explained, I just don't have the money. And it was all right. It was all right. And they all go, yeah. And the lady said, for the first time in my life, I crossed the street with the carriage, and it was all right. It was all right. And they all go, yeah. I said, Joe, what the hell are they nodding at? And he said, they're identifying their feelings. And I had the slightest idea what he's talking about. Because where I came from and where I was raised, you never talked about feelings. There were three or four or five ways that completely covered the emotions and feelings. You said good, pretty good, bad, pretty bad. You know, and in order to get your point across, you merely raised the lower your voice. Five things. Good, good, bad, bad, bad. I mean, have you said anything more, you were bullshitting. You said anything less, you were crybaby. So, I mean, I don't know. But I happened to be at a meeting, and this lady, and the only thing I can remember about the lady was she was married, she had two kids, she had glasses, she had red hair and a broken nose, and she came from Queens. And that's the only thing I knew about her. And right in the middle of the qualification, I caught myself nodding like a mule. Man, I was going up and down. The bells were going up and down. And I first shot my sponsor later on, Joe, and I said, Joe, you hear this? And I kept telling him, he said, that's right. That's right. Now you're identifying. I don't know that lady, ladies and gentlemen. She could be here for all I know. But it was she had opened a whole new world of identification with another human being. I may never see you again. I don't know anything about you. But the moment you tell me you're an alcoholic, I know you. And you know me. It truly is the language of the heart. She opened up this whole world to me. And I immediately nicknamed Lele the Land of Nod. And I'd be hustling along the street, and the guy comes staggering out of the bar. He's Brian, where are you going? Where are you going? So I'm going, Land of Nod, you know, Land of Nod. He's like, give me a few bucks. And later on, word got back to me that they didn't see me anymore. They were trying to figure out what the Land of Nod was. And they came up with the conclusion that I was a natural hour club with a lot of women, and I was the boss. And I wouldn't tell them about it. Well, anyway, I just loved it. I go to meetings and I see everybody nodding and the buzz would be going off. And every time I would identify and every time I'd be nodding, a little piece of me was coming back to me. The miracle of identification. It was coming back to me. And I remember I was about a year sober. I was still working with the Dynamite only now. I was working up in Van Cortlandt Park in the shaft up there. And I was working till the midnight. And I would get up around 11 o'clock in the morning, and I'd have breakfast at this ideal restaurant. And right across the street was a big nightclub, and outside that a park bench. And I would sit on the park bench and have a container of coffee and a cigarette, and I'd sort of get myself together before I get in the train, make that long haul up to Van Cortlandt Park. And this particular day, I'm sitting there, and I had a container of coffee in my hand, a cigarette, and smoking away. And up the block from this here, little kid, looked like a little Shirley Temple. Little crumpled knees and little skirt on her and the curls bouncing on her hand. She had this big lollipop and she spots me and she comes running up, she comes jumping right up on my lap. I'm sitting down, I'm looking at this here kid and I got the coffee and I'm looking at her and she's pushing the lollipop at me. I'm looking down, the mother come up and I looked up at the mother and the mother says, she wants you to lick the lollipop. So I took the lollipop, I stuck it in my mouth, I gave it a big slurp and I rolled my eyes and I took it out and gave it to the kid and she popped it in the mouth, jumped off my lap and went skipping up the block. And I'm looking at the mother nod, I nod, and I'm watching the two of them walk away from me. And all of a sudden as I watched them walking away, this tremendous feeling of love overcame me. This tremendous feeling, it almost lifted me off the bridge and I couldn't figure out what it was, I just couldn't figure it out. And I kept saying that. I heard myself saying to me, Brian, this is the God we've been talking about. This is the God of the rooms. This is the God of sobriety. And I just couldn't believe it. God. I mean, with a cigarette in my mouth, a taste of a kid's lollipop and a coffee, and God. And I said, God bless you, God. I went over his head to the boss or something. I mean, I'm just waiting to go to work. And I remember I had stayed away from all step meetings and closed discussions because of the concept of God. I walked away from the God that I was raised with at 14 and nobody, including you, was about to ram God down my throat. But I happened to be at this meeting, I remember, and they went into the concept of God. And one said it was this, another said it was this. And I remember this young man saying the way he had heard God was G-O-D, good orderly direction. G-O-D, good orderly direction. Speaking only for myself, ladies and gentlemen. When I heard that G-O-D, good orderly direction, it just seems like my chest split open. And centuries of venom and stink brought out. Now here was a God that I could understand. As far as I was concerned, that's what God was supposed to know all along, was good orderly direction. But somehow the way I was raised and born, I just couldn't buy it, but this I could. And I remember sitting back, and behind the speaker that had the slogans, first things first, keep it simple, let go and let God. And the way I read it was first things first, keep it simple, let go and let good orderly direction. And at that moment, I literally turned my will and my life over to care of good orderly direction as I understood it. And that was you. Anyway, and the only thing that you were asking of me was to try to stay away from the drink. Try to do the best you can, try to get to a meeting. And it wasn't so much that it was a concept of God, because they kept telling me, Brian, don't you ever worry about God. You pick up a drink, they won't be sending God back to the detox. They'll be sending you. It's you and that first drink. It's always you and that first drink. Remember that. But the word that got me was that word direction. That word just hooked me. Ladies and gentlemen, all my life I had been looking for some type of direction. I'd be a liar if I stood up here and told you all I ever do is drink and carouse around and fall up. That's not me at all. That's not the story of me. I was always trying to be a man. I was always trying to do the right thing. I was always shining my shoes, trying to put my best foot forward. I was always washing my face, combing my hair, trying to make that first good, long, lasting impression. I was always saying I'm sorry. I was always making amends. I was always looking for work. I was always an alcoholic. I was always picking up a drink. And I was always, and always, the years of the desolate always. And here I was in a room full of alcoholics offering me good early direction in my life. Now, I may have been everybody's drunk, but I assure you I was never anybody's fool. I knew right then and there that if I didn't make it here with you, I wasn't about to make it. And here it was now, this God experience, and everything started to come together. And I was making meetings and active and coming and going. And I was about 4 years sober when I got a phone call from San Francisco in 1976 that they were going to crew up the bicentennial ship with an East Coast crew, and what I like to be part of the crew. Now, I hadn't sailed since they flew me home from Tokyo, and I was on it. And they said in about 2 weeks we'll be flying up to Bath, Maine, and so you'll go down and get your inoculations, get signed on, crew to the Coast Guard, which I did. And about a week before I was to leave, a friend of mine, Roy, was on a drunk, and Ronnie, his sponsor, was on his way to pick him up to take him to a detox. And before he got there, whatever went through Ronnie's, Roy's head, I don't know. But before he got there, he opened the window and he drove out 27 stories. So when he got there, it was a mess. The cops were there, the fire department was there. He had a wife, 5 kids, it was a mess. And Roy was half Irish Catholic and half Jewish, and his mother flew in from San Francisco for the memorial service. They had him cremated, and there was a lot of recriminations and finger pointing and arguing. And afterward, they were fighting over the ashes. And I got Ronnie, his sponsor, together, and we got the mother, and we got the wife, and we sat down. And I told him I'd be leaving in a week, and Roy had gone to see many years earlier. Why not give me the ashes, and I'll take him to see, and I'll bury him at sea, give him a seaman's burial. And that was about the only thing they agreed on, and they did. And the captain was notified there'll be a burial at sea. And we got out there, I went up and I saw the captain, and he said, all right. He said, you got the death certificate, Brian? I said, no, I didn't know I needed one. He said, well, this is an official burial. He said, you need the death certificate. He said, I'll tell you what, when we get to Panama, call his wife up, have her send all the necessary papers to the West Coast, and when we leave San Francisco, we'll bury him in the Pacific. And I did. And she sent the papers, and we sailed out. We're a few days out of sea, and the captain came, happened to see me on the deck. He said, well, Brian, when do you want to hold a service? And I said, Captain, if it's at all possible, I'd like to bury him on the international dateline, if that's okay with you. And he said, all right, we come to the international dateline, we'll bury him. And it was important to me, ladies and gentlemen. It was important to me to bury him on the international dateline. Because as far as I'm concerned, the one true internationalist is the alcoholic. As George said last night, we've been around for about 12,000 years. I mean, they've written operas about us and movies and books and novels. I mean, we've been around. We go back to the beginning of fermentation. That's how old we are. Well, as old as fermentation. I mean, first there was the Iceman, and then the Neanderthal man, and all along us, the drunken man. I mean, we've been there all along. And I tell you, if there's anyone that should be buried on the international dateline, it should be an alcoholic. It should be one of us. And the day came, and I remember it was a gorgeous night. The sky, if you had to go down, that's the one you want to go down with. It was a beautiful sky, and I remember the ship slowing down, all the passengers come out, and the officers come out, and the crew come out, was standing there. You had the pint with the ashes and the American flag, and before I sailed out of San Francisco, I brought 5 long-stem red roses for the children, and 1 long-stem yellow rose for the wife, and I had them stapled together to the little serenity card prayer that we had, and I made a little wreath out of it. And I had the agreement from the captain that he finished the service with the Our Father. And I remember the ship slowing down, and he picked up the service, and the ashes went in, and the flowers went in there. And I remember the flowers being sucked along the wake of the ship. And I'm looking in the distance, and I'm seeing it spinning. And the ship, you could feel picking up, and the smoke coming out, and the blowing the whistle, saluting the departed brother. And the ship picked up speed. I'm looking in the distance at the flowers, and I'm thinking, I really don't know what went through Ray's head when he drove out that 27 story, drunk and confused and frightened. But here he was in the middle of the ocean, in the international dateline, being buried with AA dignity.
He was being buried with AA fellowship. He was being buried with you and I. That's what we do, ladies and gentlemen. We dignify one another. They say the eyes are the windows of the soul. The newcomer comes in, what I like to think, what they see in our eyes is hope. What they don't see is that shining gift of dignity in that outstretched hand. That's what we are. We walk with sober dignity. God, I mean, what a gift. And I went up to the bridge and I got the longitude and latitude and I had photographs taken. When I got to Yokohama, I mailed it to the wife. So to this day, anytime she can go to the map and trace out the longitude and the latitude and say, this is where my husband was buried. And the kids can go and say, this is where my father was buried. And in time, the grandchildren can go and say, this is where my grandfather was buried. And they can do it with dignity. They can do it. They'll never know where, never know where it came from. But we dignify. And the ship sailed on before I left. I had registered with GSO as an internationalist. And they had given me a list of people from all over the world. And on the list was a loner. There's this missionary way up in the back hills of Taiwan. And he was on, I started to correspond with him. And he wrote me and he said, Brian, if you ever get here long enough and you get up here, he said, I'd like to take, he was sober 5 years. He said, I'd like to take the fifth step with you. He was sober 5 years and never spoke to another human being, another alcoholic. It was all done through GSO, through tapes, through internationalists. And I was the first one to come face to face. And after a few trips, the ship finally got in. I had enough time. I rented out a car. I got the driver. We went clippity-clap over the mud. I was away in the back hills, and I met him. And I spent the whole day taking the first step with him. And he'd go into long tangents of English, and next thing his eyes would roll in retrospect, and next thing he'd go on and on in Chinese, and he'd weave in and out, and looking at the paper, and he'd be talking Chinese and this and that. And I just realized how lucky I had been to sober up in New York. I mean, here, like George says, right across the street at the meeting. I mean, I sobered up. There's nothing like going eyeball to eyeball with another alcoholic. And here this man was 5 years sober. And I realized how lucky I was, but how blessed he was. That there is such a thing as GSO. And people who correspond with another and put me in touch with people and people in touch with them. And ladies and gentlemen, AA literally reaches out from the four points of the compass. Don't ever be afraid to get out and travel. I mean, get out there and see the world. Get out there. Don't ever worry about AA. The great thing is, if you come to a country or if you come to a town or a city and AA isn't there when you get there, AA is there when you got there. Because you're AA and she's AA and I'm AA and we're the hand of AA. I mean, so get out there and see the world. Don't ever be afraid. Like I say, no matter where it is, you're there. And I came back and with the help of people in the program, I got into Fordham University, working nights, going out. In 1982, after 5.5 years, I graduated with a degree in fine art, with a BA in fine art. And I just retired, and I retired in 87 from the tunnels. I just retired from another thing. I'll be 61 at the end of the month. I'll be 23 years sober at the beginning of next month, April Fool's Day. And I did a lot of things, ladies and gentlemen. I did a lot of things. I did a lot of things sober, and I did a lot of things drunk. And today, one of the things that I did that I'm the proudest of was the very thing that I was the deepest ashamed of. And that's the fact that I couldn't drive a car. I mean, you put me in a tunnel, I could drive anything. Put me in a plane, but something about cars, I was phobic. And I was so ashamed of it. I mean, all my life, here I am with the money and the women and everything else. I couldn't drive a car and I'm always sucking around people. They had to drive me and it was a nightmare. And I was, from 1986, I think it was, a knock came at the door and I opened the door and this girl came in and she threw her license on my table. She said, come on, take your coat out. She said, we're going to register you to driving school. She just got a driver's license. I said, oh God, don't start that. What the hell are you doing? She says, come on, we're going to driving school. And literally took me by the hand, walked me up to 88th Street to a driving academy where I registered. The guy would be there every day waiting for me to take me to a driving lesson. I come to a meeting that night. You could tell I was at a driving lesson because I look like the Michelin man. I come in, I'd be all locked up, the sweat. And they took me to, and guys wet nosed me and let me drive the cars and took me over the bridge and under the tunnels, and the day came for me to take the test, and I took the test, and a couple of weeks later I come home from work and I put the key in, and there was a letter from the motor vehicle. And I remember I went up and I put it on the kitchen table, I made myself a cup of tea, and I opened it up, and there was my license. The tears just started to flow down my eyes. Ladies and gentlemen, this was beyond fantasy. Never in my life did I ever fantasize I was a great car, race car driver, or I had a Cadillac and I picked up the girls. I mean, I never fantasized anything, and here I was, and I had my license. Beyond fantasy. And I had it about 6 months, and this day, I don't know why, I got up, I got dressed, I went up to Avis and I rented the car. And I tried to figure out where to go, and the one place I wanted to go was to drive to a diner. I don't know why, but just to drive to a diner. And in New York, there are no diners, there's restaurants. And the only diner I knew was way out in Rockaway, about 25 miles out. And I knew you had to go over the bridge, and I knew how to get there. So I got behind the wheel of the car, and I start driving. I'm going over the bridge, and the guys in the truck are yelling, "Keep going, move over, you dumb bastard." And I'm like this here, and I'm going, and I knew how to get there. And finally, I pull up, and I spot the diner, and I park the car, and I get out, and I'm wringing wet, and the wet is pouring on me, and the sweat is pouring out of the shoes. And I'm walking up the stairs into the diner, and the pants are stuck to my ass, and I'm pulling it out. And I walked in, and I went in, and I sat at the counter. And I ordered up a cup of coffee, and they put the coffee in front of me. And ladies and gentlemen, they say everybody has 15 minutes of fame. Well, I had 3 cups of coffee that day. 3 cups of... That is, to this day, the peak moment of my life. Never in my life, to this day, had I been so proud of myself as I was then. When I graduated from Fordham, I got it. They held the services on the New York Philharmonic on the stage, and I remember when they called my name up in the captain gown, I got the part. I was proud then, but it pales in comparison to how I felt at that moment, sitting there soaking wet, having that coffee. And I got out, and I got in the car, and I started back in the car on, and you know how the voice is always there. The voice started digging in me. Look at him driving that car. Look at him looking over the shoulder. Look at him turning that wheel with one hand. What a man! What a man! And as I said, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be 61, 22-year server, college graduate, driver's license. And I wish I could stand up here right now and tell you that I finally know what I want to be when I grow up. But the honest fact is I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. And I found out in this room that it's really not all that important. It's really not that important to know who you are. What is important is to recognize what you're not. I'm not that young man the FBI took in handcuffs, put up the ship in Mobile, Alabama, and stood trial for near killing a man. I'm not that man the FBI took off in handcuffs in New York and stood trial for mutiny. I'm not that man dragging a woman out of the car by the hair of the head, dragging her back into the bar because I haven't finished drinking yet. I'm not that man walking by looking at sitting in the saloon looking out, vacantly staring out at people passing by. I'm not that old, young, dirty man on the corner begging for money to get into. I'm not that young, dirty man being shuffled into a detox. No, ladies and gentlemen, thanks to you, I am not a lot of things today. I am not a lot of things today. Thanks to you and this magnificent program. And somehow, by seeing the many things that I am not, then I begin to see the many things that I am. It's that paradox. And on those rare occasions when I do have the courage and the wisdom to take a long, hard look, I see the many things I can still become if I continue to adhere to the simple program, if I continue staying away from the drink, if I continue reaching out to the suffering alcoholic. In 1976, Christmas Day, a week later I was to get up in St. Pete and fly home. It was the last time I ever saw. But I was up in San Francisco, out in Guerrero. They had a big party. All the guys from New York were there, and they knew they wouldn't be seeing me anymore, and all the guys from the Union. But I was packing it in. And as all the craziness is going in the barn, I called up the intergroup there, and they told me where there was a meeting. It was around Guerrero Street somewhere. And this was Christmas Eve. And I went to the meeting, and it was sort of a storefront, and I remember it was dark, and it had some Christmas decorations, and I had the little tin foil with candles on it lit, and I sat at the meeting. And at that meeting, I heard a lady make a statement. In the spirits of simplicity, ladies and gentlemen, it just vivified me. It really just sucked me right into my seat. In this statement, she took all of you and me and Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson and the steps and the traditions and reduced everything. She reduced everything to its lowest denominator when she said, by no means has AA opened the gates of heaven and let me in, but they sure have opened the gates of hell and let me out. And that's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. Of course we're not our brother's keeper, but we are the gatekeepers. And for that we're responsible to nudge that gate one more day, to let one more out. Ladies and gentlemen, how do I thank you? How do I thank you? And I say this in all humility, on my bended knee, I thank the Almighty God for each and every one of you. And on my other knee, I thank each and every one of you for me. Thank you for me, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.